Thanks, Robert. That story's not quite accurate, but we're getting close. Yeah, we brought Bubba. We went back and got Bubba. But anyway, what I want to talk about today is give you some background relative to my perspective of the potential for genetic improvement of health in beef cattle, some of the justification behind that, and then talk about a project that we've got going at Colorado State in cooperation with several different partners. This is a little bit out of order. Robert and I didn't have a complete opportunity to talk about when this should be presented, because tomorrow in the general session I'm actually giving a talk that kind of sets the basis for this, looking at traits that are influencing our profitability as beef producers, and it sets the stage for why we chose this and why we believe it's important. So on the front end of this, I'm going to talk a little bit about the economic justification and then go into the study and some of the results that we've seen. In the end, our goal is to reduce the incidence of disease. That's the whole goal of the project. Now, this top picture here, I was emailed that about third or fourth hand, so I don't know who took that picture. I do know it was taken in southwestern Kansas about 2 years ago, after the blizzard that wreaked havoc in southeast Colorado, southwest Kansas. And this was a steer, I believe, in a feedlot near Tribune after that blizzard. And you can tell, a lot of stress. Right? So what we want to do is select animals that typically not associated with that much stress, maybe, but that don't end up like this calf. Okay? That's our goal. And whether it's resilience or resistance to stress or tolerance to disease, I don't know we have all of the answers associated with that yet. And hopefully this study is going to shed some light on that. So I want to set the case for why we believe this is important, and I was happy this morning we had a lot of feedlot producers on the general session, and based on some survey information from last year at BIF in Fort Collins, we didn't have quite as many commercial producers represented, had a lot of seed stock breeders, and I was happy to see we had so many feedlot producers on the agenda this morning. But essentially, if you look at some of the economic studies that have been done on this problem and go back to 97, Griffin reported that the estimates of the prevention and treatment of disease in the feedlot is greater than a $3 billion industry, or $3 billion cost. Now, all my dollars, I realize we're in Canada, all my dollars are U.S. dollars, and depending on exchange rate, you guys can adjust accordingly. At the bottom, I know when I see kilogram figures, it takes me a while to figure out how many pounds that is. So those of you who are numerically challenged like I am on conversion rates, I've got both those in there. But essentially then, if you look at just the respiratory disease issues in the U.S. beef industry or cattle industry, we lose about 1.1 million cattle. The value of those is about $692 million, and that's based on a 2006 USDA report using 2005 data. So it's a pretty substantial cost to us. Now, we boil that down and back it off from a national perspective and actually look at and individual performance. I've got a couple studies here, one from Gary Snowder in 2007 that said animals that are treated for respiratory issues in the first 40 days of the feeding phase on average are about 16 pounds lighter relative to carcass weight or hot carcass weight, or 7.25 kilograms. Okay? Another study looked at not just whether the animals were treated, and this is going to have some implications for a study, for a slide I'm going to show later on, but physically whether at harvest those animals had some lung damage or lung lesions. And if you look at it from that standpoint, in this Engler study in 2007, it's about 15.4 kilograms difference in hot carcass weight, reduction if they did have lung damage, or 34 pounds as opposed to if they didn't have lung damage. Okay. So if you look at the incidence of this problem, respiratory disease complex, total feedlot deaths from 94 to 90 to 2003 increased by about 69%. Now, not sure why that happened. It could be that we're feeding over that time period feeding a lot more calf feds. Feed was relatively cheap. With the prices of corn and barley and wheat all going up, we may see a shift in that, because my guess, I'm no predictor of the future, is that we'll, but I think is what we'll see is a lot less calf-feds in the feedlot. If you look at during that same time, the incidence of bovine respiratory disease complex increased by about 118%, so more than doubled in that time period. And I borrowed this slide from Guy Lonergan from West Texas A&M University, who is, you will see, is a cooperator on this project, and he got this from the Sentinel Meat Feedlot Monitoring Program. Okay, so we set an economic basis for this. So let's talk a little bit about the genetic basis. And is there genetic variability in this trait, or resistance, or tolerance, or resilience to these disease issues? And I'm relying primarily on some work that Gary Smooters has done and reported in the Journal of Animal Science. And he looked back at some historical Meat Animal Research Center data that looked at calves from 1987 through 2001 that went through their feedlots. And the incidence over that time period of bovine respiratory disease ranged within a year from 5% to some years it was 44%. Okay, so we had a pretty wide range in the incidence of bovine respiratory issues in the feedlot. And he estimated the heritability. And for those of you just refresh your memory, heritability says how much of the differences we see in those feedlot cattle is due to genetics. Okay. And he reported that the heritability on the observed scale, meaning, yes, they were treated for bovine respiratory disease or they were not, would range from 0.04 to 0.08. But when he transformed that to the underlying continuous scale, it runs about 0.18. Meaning you have a lot of genes that influence in those animals that influence whether an animal is susceptible or shows clinical signs of bovine respiratory disease. And rather than expressing it on yes, it was treated or no, it was not, we look at it on an underlying genetic scale, it's about 18% heritable. We think about, oh, that's not very high, 18% of the differences. But at CSU, we do a lot of genetic evaluations, and we have some breeds where the heritability of milk production is 0.2, so it's not that much difference. Okay? So there is some opportunity there in my mind, and Gary concluded that selection against the susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease is practicable, and it's clearly economically important as well. Yes? They did have breed information, and there were several, if I remember that study correctly, completely on the breed differences, there were some that exhibited breed differences relative to susceptibility for BRD. And I can't remember which ones right off the top of my head, but I can give you that paper. I don't think we know that, to be honest with you. Don't think we have that information. Now, the one thing that Gary did show is that the heritability of susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease tended to increase with increases in incidence. Now, it takes a little bit to understand that, but if you think about it, animals that are under greater stress or greater potential to come down with this disease complex have more opportunity to express those genetic differences that they have. And what he did is he looked at a time period over those years where there was relatively low incidence of bovine respiratory disease, estimated heritability in those animals during that time period versus animals that were from a time period where that was relatively high incidence of bovine respiratory disease. And the heritability tended to be higher where you had that, what appears to be a greater challenge. Okay, I don't think we have that fully figured out, but as the incidence of that happens, you tend to have greater heritability. And we found that this is true on these binary traits, that is, animals, yes or no. So pregnancy, she's pregnant or not. As you get closer to that 50% threshold, we tend to see higher heritabilities. And Sam Comstock, a PhD grad from CSU, he showed that through some simulation work that for heifer pregnancy, as you get more and more heifers open, you actually get a better expression of those reproductive or the underlying genetic control of those reproductive differences. So there is some support for that being the case. In instances where you have a greater challenge or a greater incidence of the disease, we're seeing more expression of those genetic differences relative to susceptibility for bovine respiratory disease. Okay, so the idea is, yep, there's probably an opportunity for us. The evidence would show that we can actually make progress in selecting animals that have a reduced susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease, provided we have the appropriate tools. Now, the other question then becomes, what happens if we do develop these tools and we start selecting animals for this? Okay, so I went back to another study that Gary published last year and looked at the relationship of susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease with some of the performance characteristics. And same group of cattle. Obviously, Mid Animal Research Center has a lot of data on these animals. But he reported that there was low genetic correlations between bovine respiratory disease, the growth, carcass, and palatability traits, which is pretty encouraging. Okay, it's encouraging in some aspects because if we select for this, we most likely are not going to harm our palatability traits, the animal's performance in the feedlot, and some of those other issues. Okay, so it suggests we can likely improve that without adverse effects on other traits, at least the traits that we had phenotypic information on in this study. In the latest paper that came out from the Meat Animal Research Center, Cassis and Snowder reported that there is potentially a QTL for resistance to pathogenic disease. And what they did in this study is they took the information, and obviously DNA on these cattle, and combined whether they had a bovine respiratory disease incidence or had pink eye or foot rot, okay, and combine those essentially into what I understand is a binary trait. So they succumbed to one of these pathogenic diseases or they didn't, or they developed clinical signs of one of these pathogenic diseases or they didn't. And they reported that there appears to be a QTL or a quantitative trait loci that is linked to resistance or susceptibility to that. So further incidents indicating some genetic mechanisms controlling whether an animal exhibits clinical signs of these diseases. And then I realize this is a little bit of a different mechanism, but we had in one of our design studies and in our design meetings for this project, Chris Morris from New Zealand came and gave us some presentation on the genetics controlling some of the disease issues, and one of the most encouraging studies he showed that is in some of the selection lines against fecal egg counts in sheep, they could actually show a 40-fold difference in high versus low selected lines. So indicating that there's some genetic variability for those traits. Okay, so because of this economic importance and the opportunity to actually select animals that have a reduced susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease, and by being economic, it's an economically relevant trait, we initiated a study to further investigate some of these the genetic control of resistance to bovine respiratory disease. And this is all possible because of the National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium, which, as you've heard last night with John Pollock, is a special grant-funded consortium in the U.S. that comes through Congress, and they divvy out a little bit of money to help seed essentially some of these projects, and this is one that we have initiated as a result of the framework that money allowed us to develop. Developed numerous relationships with a variety of large producers and some feedlots, and it allowed us to undertake the study that I'm about to talk to you a little bit about. So to give you some background, what we wanted to do is to further investigate whether we can develop selection tools against this problem. And we got roughly 1,550 steers last fall, the first week in November, from a single ranch source in Nebraska. And we shipped those to a cooperating feedlot. So when you own feedlots or retain ownership, you know the importance of this. And they were pretty interested in participating with us. And it's a Five Rivers cattle feeding lot right there outside of Lamar, Colorado. So shipped those cattle over the course of 3 days, 341 miles, or what is that, about 570 kilometers, I believe, and took them to the feedlot there. And the good thing about this feedlot is that Colorado State University also has a research yard right immediately adjacent to it. Being an 80,000 head yard, the cattle on this study were actually housed in the commercial yard, so we knew they were going to be exposed to everything that the cattle in that yard happened to be carrying. And had one epidemiologist come and talk to me as those cattle arrived, they were delivered holding pens and walked down an alley, and Hannah Van Kampen says, if our cattle are housed next to this specific pen, we're going to have a lot of dead ones, is what she said. So we knew there were a lot of health issues, and they were going to be exposed to a lot of these. Thankfully, we weren't housed next to those, but anyway. So here's the research yard, and then the commercial yard, which is, you know, roughly 80,000 head of steers and heifers. Give you a little background on the cattle. The cattle had been vaccinated twice on the ranch, and they were subject to roughly a 45-day backgrounding program before we put them on the trucks and shipped them. The cattle were shipped early every day, gathered, put right on the truck, and shipped to Lamar. When they arrived, it was usually 5 or 6 at night. We held them over one day in the receiving pens for the commercial yard, and then we began processing those the following day. Now, sometimes because of the numbers associated with this and all the phenotypes that we collected, which I'm going to discuss here in a little bit, we couldn't get through a whole day's shipment in a single processing day. So some animals did stay 2 days before they were processed. During the initial processing, we collected DNA for extraction and storage. All of these cattle are we have the ability to sire identify them through the use of DNA markers. We have roughly half of those done now, and the rest are in the process of getting that done to identify sires. A little bit of information in the background of the study. When the cattle arrived, we did not revaccinate. Remember, they'd had 2 vaccinations on the ranch. And if you remember back to some of my previous slides, we wanted a higher incidence of bovine respiratory disease. We want to see, you know, as much expression of the different genetic differences relative to susceptibility that we could see. As you'll see in a minute, we got that. So that's why we did not vaccinate upon arrival. We administered normal wormers, and then also we've implanted these cattle as well. And as you can see, we had a whole host of graduate students and faculty helping on the initial processing, and I think you'll see why we needed so many people there at the start. Give you a little more background information to before we start talking about the outcomes of this project and some of the phenotypes we were actually collecting. In the design of the program, we asked a number of veterinarians, how do you know an animal's sick? So is it elevated body temperature? Is it because they're off feed? And really getting an objective measure of why an animal is identified as sick at this point is not easy. So we decided to go with industry procedures, and the cowboys at Colorado Beef, are the ones that, you know, they ride all 80,000 the cattle in that feedlot. They're the ones that identify whether an animal's sick. Now, once that's done, because we have a whole host of samples that we take and do some pretty in-depth measurements on the sick animals, we then move them to our Southeast Colorado Research Center, which made this facility particularly suited because we could do that. The cattle were right there, and we had the ability to keep them in hospital pens until we deemed them recovered. And along those lines, as far as defining sick, again, I borrowed some information from Guy Lonrog and papers from Whittam in 96 and Thompson in 2003. There's actually 2 studies, and I've averaged the results of those here. And I want you to, for a moment, I want you to remember that these 2 studies averaged a 31% poll rate. Okay, so what the two groups did is they obviously recorded when an animal was pulled or not pulled or treated or not treated. And then when those animals were harvested, they went through and looked at all the wounds and said, does this animal have wound damage or not? Okay. So of the animals that were treated or identified as showing clinical signs of bovine respiratory disease, so they did get some treatment, were identified as sick, 70% of those when they were harvested had some lung damage somewhere in their lungs. Okay, 30% of those treated had no lung lesions. Okay, so no lung damage. Now, of those not treated, so animals that were never pulled from their feedlot pens, okay, 56% of those had some lung damage. Okay, and 44% of the ones not treated had no lung lesions. Okay, well, if you're looking at genetic differences and maybe a potential physiological mechanism behind that, what's especially interesting are those 2 cells. Okay, because animals that were not treated or ever pulled
means either the feedlot cowboy missed them, okay, or they had lung damage prior to ever arriving at the feedlot, or maybe they have the ability to be more tolerant or a higher ability to fight off these infections and some of the problems that goes along with bovine respiratory disease. And obviously these animals are pretty interesting because with a 31% average poll rate, they never come down with clinical signs associated with this problem. So we've done a similar type of study design where, as you will see, we've gone through and collected lung lesion scores on all the cattle as they were harvested. Treated animals, a little bit about that. First treatment, our protocol. We used the same protocol that was in place at the commercial lot. They were treated, and then after 5 days, they were evaluated and then potentially get retreated at 7 days. If they were deemed recovered, they were able to go back to their original home pen. These cattle were housed in their home pen anywhere from 90 head pens to 315 head pens. And unfortunately, we had lung damage in a fair number of cattle. This wasn't one of these, but we've had a fair bit of death loss, and we did necropsies on those, pulled bacteria samples as well, and looked at our lung lesion problems relative to the animals that did not make it out of the feeding phase. So some of the phenotypes that we collected, whether the animal's sick, yes or no, how long it took them to recover given the typical commercial treatment protocol in place at that lot. Of course, recorded drugs and body temperatures and weight change over the time they were in the sick pens. With any mortalities, we got necropsy results and fluorescent antigen tests and bacteriologies. And then one of our other outcomes, as I just mentioned, was lung lesion scores as they went through the plant. We actually had two evaluators, so as those lungs came down the line, we had two independent evaluators determine does this animal have lung damage or not. Means you have to score a lung about every 6 seconds. So we kept those guys on their toes. Then we have BVD, persistently infected animal information, respiration rates when the animals were sick, visual scores typical of in use at the feedlot relative to nasal discharge, eye, cough, depression, rapid breathing, etc. Performance traits, the weight traits, the things that make us money. We've got weights at all of at the arrival. The cattle after arrival were re-implanted two times, so it was a pretty aggressive implant protocol. And then, of course, carcass weights when they were slaughtered. And then all of these carcass traits we gathered as well. Ultrasound, whenever we re-implant, we got ultrasound data so we can track back fat and marbling deposition relative to animals that were sick or not sick, lung lesions or no lung lesions, and help us to assign some value on this genetic tools once they're hopefully developed. When the animals arrive, we're also looking at stress and some of the behavior characteristics associated with these animals. So we have physiological measures of how much stress was the animal under when it came through at the first processing. We have a variety of temperament measures. Bob Weber from University of Missouri is involved, and he did all of the flight speed at the initial processing and then again at the first re-implant period. And then we had two independent evaluators relative to a shoot score, how they behaved in the shoot when they were first restrained. And, of course, I already talked about the stress indicators. Some of the other baseline disease and immunological status measures we've recorded, looking for exposure in the feedlot to all of these organisms, BVD1 and 2, PI3, IBR, and BRSV, you know, your primary causes of some of the bovine respiratory disease issues. We've done a number of tests for differences in immune response, so how much of an influence the cell-mediated response have relative to the other mechanism, and then we have body temperature profiles as well on these cattle. Environmental variables, we have a station on site. We have a backup weather station at the airport a mile away. Actually, Scott Spidell is presenting some results on this at the animal science meetings next week relative to the influence of weather on incidence of bovine respiratory disease. We had pretty large fluctuations in temperature on arrival in Lamar when these cattle arrived and later on as well. And then also, of course, any stresses associated with ration composition changes. So what we've got here is the first 38 days. It's typical of a bovine respiratory disease outbreak, what we see after arrival. So my graduate student, Brian Brigham, put this graph together looking at two-day periods up to 38 days post-arrival. We saw a pretty big peak in animals that were pulled for respiratory disease early on, and like most studies show, tapered off there towards the end as well. The current status, this isn't the final. The animals just were harvested a week before last, but this is up to about June 1. We had a 45% overall treatment rate, which is great if you're looking for genetic variability, not very good if you own the cattle. So we got what we wanted relative to expression of susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease. Of those animals, we had a 45 treatment rate. 22% of those were retreated. That means they went through the second protocol before they ever went back to the home pen. And of the 45%, 66% returned to the home pen and they were pulled later on for respiratory issues. Our overall mortality rate, we've got a lot of necropsy samples, 6.25%, a lot higher than what I was hoping for. I was hoping for this, but not much of that. Didn't quite succeed in that. But 14% of those treated were mortality. So I think we've got a very good data set for determining genetic differences, and again, not a very good data set if you're hoping to make money on these cattle. And again, they were back, they were treated. Everything you could do at the ranch before they arrived was done right. 45-day background period, vaccinated twice, and we still saw this this incidence of disease. So our next step then is to begin to quantify some of the relationships amongst those phenotypes, determine the amount and nature of the genetic control associated with those differences, and we do a study all again next year to hopefully gather more data. It's designed as a two-year study, so we'll have roughly 3,200 calves that have gone through this. Now, the next year, we're going to go ahead and vaccinate animals just like the commercial feedlot would upon arrival, and got a little bit of a different contemporary group effect. But again, our ultimate goal is to develop some tools that are going to help us to select animals that have a greater resistance or tolerance or greater or reduced susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease. And as I pointed out earlier, there's going to be, as we move forward with this and maybe collect data or identify markers that are going to help us select animals and put those together with some selection tools. Clearly, there are some groups of animals when you have an outbreak that are going to be more valuable from a data standpoint, and the markers will hopefully be applicable throughout the range of incidence rates. I got to acknowledge the team because I'm just the spokesperson. We've got on the team, we've got Guy Lonergan from West Texas A&M, Hanna Van Kampen and Craig Peel from CSU. I already mentioned Bob Weber. Chris Chase, South Dakota State, Janine Salek Johnson, who's a stress physiologist from the University of Illinois. Of course, John Pollock is part of the National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium. Tony Bryant is the director of research at the Five Rivers Cattle Feeding Company. John Wagner, who runs the Southeast Colorado Research Center. And then we couldn't have done this without the graduate students. There were a couple days, this is part of Brian and Chase's projects, where things didn't look too well for them, and I recognize Brian in the back of the room relative to treatment rates and getting all of this done when they're pulling 160 head a day of sick calves. So they put a fair bit of work into that. And with that, I'll answer any questions, and if not, I'll turn it over to Mark or Robert.
Okay.